This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Sheryl Crow, is touring this summer in support of her latest album, Detours. She'll be hitting Colorado and California next week, Europe and Nashville in July, and, among other places, Philadelphia and Las Vegas in August. Sheryl Crow went from anonymity to celebrity with the release of her first album, Tuesday Night Music Club, in 1993. Her career is filled with platinum and multi-platinum selling albums. And hits like All I Want to Do, Every Day is a Winding Road, If It Makes You Happy, Soak Up the Sun, and My Favorite Mistake. She's won 9 Grammys. Crow's new album, Detours, was released in February and reunited her with Bill Bottrell, the producer of her first album. Detours reflects some of the big changes in her life over the past 3 years, including separating from her fiancé Lance Armstrong, her breast cancer diagnosis and treatment, and the adoption of her son, Wyatt. Sheryl Crow visited Terry Gross in the Fresh Air Studios in February when Detours came out on CD. A little later, she'll perform some solo songs, but she's going to start with her band backing her.
Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. I'd like to ask you to start with a song. Sheryl, would you introduce the song for us?
We're going
to
do Shine Over Babylon.
I walk the heat of 7 hills in this talk of losing wills. Great highways in a constant melt. Men and women and children all have overbuilt. Buying bread and paying for none. Creatures of a waning sun. Teachers' hands are overrun. Clowns and gypsies all but gone.
Make me wanna shine over Babylon. Make me wanna shine over Babylon.
Freedom's etched on sacred pillars. Hollow stones on mindless fillers. Could lead to madman oil drillers. It won't be long before we all are killers. Little boy lost way up the mount. Cities drowned in under boiling founts. I dreamed of chilly sunlit days. I was trembling in the golden haze. Message from the mount. Leave your possession, hope abound. There's nothing here for you to cry about. We're all just followers from here on out. I take the stage, I walk the planks. I sing these songs with little thanks. I wait for shouts from crazy cranks. I stand amidst. I found my way to Alexandria, the gurus bubble up on Ganges. Scavengers, they run up and hand you all the junk that should have damned.
Shine
over Babylon.
Make me
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for performing that.
Thank you.
And that was Sheryl Crow with guitarist Tim Smith and Peter Stroud, Jeremy Stacey on drums, and that's one of the songs that they do on the new CD, Detours. Sheryl, is there a story behind the song?
Well, I worked with Bill Bottrell on this record, and I hadn't worked with him since the first record, which was Tuesday Night Music Club. And really the story behind the idea of the song was Bill came in, first day, neither one of us had really been in touch for nearly 13 years, just off and on really a little bit. So we were both kind of anxious, and but it just settled into this wonderful creative place that we knew we both were probably going to settle into. And it was really like a homecoming, and this idea was something that he had brought in, and it just inspired so many lyrics in me, and we recorded it the first day we were in the studio. So it really was kind of affirming that our creative life together was still very vital, and that it was going to be a fun record and a very intense record. This was the beginning of what I feel like were a lot of very pointed and fearless lyrics that were to come from the sessions, and mainly just, you know, these are the times we're living in, and having him around to kind of support me in writing about things I really care about was fantastic. It was a real luxury.
Some of it's more topical, more political, personal too.
Personal, yeah. A lot of things happened to me in the last, well, I went through a lot of things in the last 3 or 4 years. And
yeah, can I just like name a few?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you separated from Lance Armstrong, mm-hmm. you had breast cancer,
right.
You have a 7-month-old baby now that
yes.
you adopted.
Yeah.
Those are real big life changes.
Those are the big personal changes, and then obviously I, like everyone else, am going through the chaos that of what's happening to the planet and the fear around that, and also the campaign of fear that we've all been kind of dragged through with this administration, and just a sense of feeling hopelessness. But at the end of the day, like with this song, I really hoped that the song would be a bit of a battle cry to incite hope that everything is not lost, that even though it seems dire, that we still have a voice and we still have the opportunity to incite a change.
How does someone like you, who writes like such great hooky, you know, pop kind of songs, start to incorporate like more political themes in mm-hmm. it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've always had, you know, I've always had one or two songs on a record that were political or extremely personal. Like we had Redemption Day on the second record, I guess, and a lot of social topics, but none of those songs ever surfaced as being pop oriented. And so this record was nice in that a lot of the hooks wound up just working out to sound very, mm-hmm. very pop oriented. Although pop has changed so much, I don't expect really to get a lot of airplay. But it's like you and I were speaking before this interview. It's the Wild West out there. People
in the music industry.
And I think the mindset now is that music, people don't feel like they should have to pay for it. And so for me on this record, not only my objective, but my hope is that people will just hear it, you know, and that it might actually move some molecules, inspire people to feel.
I'm going to ask you to do another song, mm-hmm. and this is the song that kicks off your new CD, mm-hmm. Detours. And on the CD, you do it solo, just voice and guitar. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to do it that way for us now. But before mm-hmm. you do it, introduce it for us. Tell us something about writing it.
Well, this song is called God Bless This Mess, and towards the end of the sessions, we recorded 24 tracks in 40 days, and we recorded at my farm in Nashville, and literally my farm is out in the middle of nowhere, so it felt like we were really removed from anything even resembling human life, and particularly representing the industry. So I felt like I was kind of left to my own devices, for better or for worse. And on Sunday morning, I was reading the New York Times, and there was an article, which I don't even remember what it was about, but the title was Bless This Mess. And it just all of a sudden kind of kicked off this song, which ultimately is about where we are as a nation. Daddy's in the hallway hanging pictures on the wall. Mama's in the kitchen making casseroles for all. 'Cause my brother came home yesterday from somewhere far away. He doesn't look like I remember, he just stares off into space. He must have seen some ugly things he just can't seem to say. Oh, God bless this mess. God bless this mess. I got a job in town selling insurance on the phone with Robert and Teresa and two con men from back home. Everyone I call up doesn't have the time to chat. Everybody is so busy doing this and doing that. Something has gone missing and it makes me kind of sad. Oh, God bless this mess. God bless this mess. God bless this mess. Heard about the day that two skyscrapers came down. Firemen, policemen, and people came from all around. The smoke covered the city and the body count did rise. The president spoke words of comfort with tears in his eyes. Then he led us as a nation into a war all based on lies. Oh, God bless this mess. God bless this mess. God bless this mess. God bless this mess.
That was great. That's Sheryl Crow singing a song that kicks off her new CD, Detours, and that's a new song called God Bless This Mess. Sheryl, let me ask you how your health is now. I'm sure our listeners mm-hmm. want to know. A lot of people know that you had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. You caught it really early on.
Really early, yeah. I just had my year and a half, and everything looks great. And I'll continue for 3 years having every 6 month checkups. But I really, that was such an odd experience in and of itself, because my relationship was with somebody who was so well known as a cancer survivor that
right.
was
right after you separated, you got cancer.
Yeah, it was right. really an interesting time in my life. But I think the great thing that came out of it was that I became sort of a spokesperson for early detection, and I have a very large fan base of women, so, and even young women. So it's great to be able to encourage people to not only be diligent about getting their mammograms, but to at least know their family history and to do self-checks. And until we have a cure for cancer, prevention is the best opportunity that we have.
While you were getting the radiation mm-hmm. treatment, was there a period of just kind of like, keeping to yourself, staying quiet, mm-hmm. and kind of reflecting and just summoning whatever, summoning yeah. your strength and stuff? And when that period was over, do you feel like you were changed in any way by having period of time?
It was really an informative time, and really I think ultimately it was really created a huge expansion in my life on a lot of levels. I think it's probably always been my propensity to just stay busy instead of getting bogged down with feelings, and I've always gone to my music for any kind of pain I ever felt, and so this was really an exercise in holding an emotion and really just working through the pain and not making myself busy. And I think we all have probably, to a certain extent, perfected that in our Western upbringing of not really sitting with an emotion and dealing with it. Instead, we push it down and it just becomes a part of our makeup. And that certainly is not good for our health. But I really, really met myself every morning at 7:30 on that radiation table with this huge... I call it a mothership, with its beams shooting into my body. And anybody that's gone through radiation will attest it. It's something you can only do by yourself. And you really have to consider from that moment forward what you want your life to look like and who you want to be and how you're going to treat yourself. And one of the things that I learned from that experience, and I think there is a lesson in cancer, just like any diagnosis, and that was that I have to really put myself first from here on out, and that I can't take care of everybody else and everybody else's needs and wants and before my own, because ultimately what happens is that I suffer. So, and I've talked to so many women who've had breast cancer, and they all kind of testify to the their own experience that the breasts represent nourishment and nurturing, and that their lesson is that they have never allowed anyone to nurture them or nourish them, that they've always been giving out. So this was really a wonderful lesson for me.
Can I point out that after the cancer, you decided to become a mother and adopted a baby?
I did. Now you are officially
A nurturer and are completely responsible for another life. So in a way, you've just taken on the kind of responsibility.
And he's putting somebody's
needs before your own.
Yeah, and that was really a decision too. I felt like when I came out of radiation, I really, actually through the whole experience, I sat with myself and tried to just envision what I wanted my life to be, because I felt like I'd really gotten thrown off course. I was raised in a family with parents who'd been married for 50 years. We're all very close. And so that was what I thought my life was going to look like. And obviously I have this other incredible life of being able to be a musician and I'm on the road. So my life isn't conventional. And yet that part of my life was missing. And so I decided when I was had completed radiation that I would start the adoption process, because I felt this mothering instinct. And Wyatt came in about a year later, came in May, and he's a great little teacher. I mean, he seems to sort of know everything. So it's been a really rewarding 7 months.
Our guest is singer and songwriter Sheryl Crow. Sheryl Crow writes songs with great musical hooks. Here's a medley of some of her most famous ones. A medley of some of Sheryl Crow's hits. Let's get back to her conversation with Terry. She asked Sheryl Crow about her process of writing songs.
Does the hook come first, or does the hook come
You
later?
Hope it comes first. Mm-hmm. I grew up, my parents were just, are amazing musicians, and I grew up in a household with a Magnavox, and they played everything from Cole Porter and Ella Fitzgerald to the Beatles and James Taylor and Motown and Mahalia Jackson and Aretha, and I had this incredible introduction to all kinds of music and a real appreciation for everything and for all kinds of music as well. And so when I was growing up, everything was about melody. And so on my best day, the melody comes first with a strong hook, and then everything else falls in line after that. On this record, I found that the music and the lyrics were coming together. In fact, the song I just sang, God Bless This Mess, I wrote at the kitchen table, and it was about 10 minutes of writing. And that's, you know, on your best day, that's when you can get out of your own way and not self-edit and not be critical and just let it flow.
Now, you said that God Bless This Mess, you'd seen a Bless This Mess headline, mm-hmm. and then the song came to you. What about hooks like All I Want to Do Is Have Some Fun?
That one actually was very similar to God Bless This Mess in that title. In fact, a lot of the lyric to that song came from a poet named Wynn Cooper, who's a teacher up in Vermont. I think he teaches poetry, in fact. And this song was recorded during the Tuesday Night Music Club sessions, and this little rat pack that I was hanging around with, we would go out and drink margaritas and hit all the seedy joints and then come back and work on music. And this song, we had this musical idea, and there was a book of poetry right in front of me, so I started using this lyric called Fun and thought later on I'll write lyrics. I wrote 5 different sets of lyrics, and none of them compared in the spirit to that. So I called Wynn and said, I know you don't know me. Nobody does. I didn't have a record out. And I said, I've written a song, and we'll send it to you and cut you into the publishing and all that. And that's how it happened.
Did he like it?
He loved it. Yeah. Especially when the checks started
rolling
in.
He really loved it after that. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the Tuesday Night Music Club, which was a group of songwriters that you work with early in your career. What was it like to have a group like that?
Well, I'll backtrack a little bit. I had made a record for A&M, a quite expensive record, with a producer who was very well known and a fantastic producer, but just... we weren't very well suited. So I made this record and asked A&M not to put it out. And then I kicked around for about a year and started hearing rumblings around town that I was getting ready to be dropped from my label. And about that time, I met Bill Bottrell and was invited out to what they were calling the Tuesday Night Music Club sessions. And they'd only had one jam session. I came to the second one and met David Bearwald and Dan Schwartz and Kevin Gilbert and Brian McLeod and Bill. And it was great fun. And we got together about 3 more times, and from those sessions came Leaving Las Vegas and All I Want to Do and maybe a couple of others. And then at that point, Bill and I decided we would start making a record, and then the two of us just were in the studio and we would invite people to come in and overdub. But really the impetus of the record were the jam sessions.
Now, you mentioned you had an album that you asked your record company to not release.
Yeah, I know.
Why didn't you want them to release
bold
it?
Bold and brazen. Well... back then, most of what was on the radio was Madonna and Paula Abdul, very dance-oriented tracks. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you had very slick stuff like Tony Childs. And so the producer who signed me actually, and as a precursor to this, I'd been turned down by every label in Hollywood. And I happened to hand my tape to Hugh Padgham, and he loved it. And he loved the demos. And the demos were very slick, and they were made on what it was the equivalent of Pro Tools at the time. And I think his love for the demos in some ways prevented him from hearing the essence and from being able to get it a more rock sound, which is what I come from. So ultimately, when I handed the record in, it was so slick, I felt like that ultimately I'd just be lost in the bins and the record bins way back when we had records. And so they were okay about it. You know, after much begging and pleading, I said, look, just give me a chance to really be who I am. And, you know, I promise it'll be more interesting. And then they did, but it took a while for us to get there.
But there were your songs on that album that you killed,
right?
There
were, yeah.
Do you remember any of those songs? Could you do an excerpt of one of those songs for us?
I can do a little bit of you know, it's hard for me to remember a lot of that stuff. And actually, a lot of it went on to be covered. In fact, this one, I think Celine Dion covered. I don't revisit that album very much, to be honest, but I know you can get it on the internet for some ridiculous amount of money. There's a time for love and a time for healing. Can't go back and undo what's been done. It's word of mouth. Time is revealing just how far we've let this kingdom come. All in all. Some will lie for you, some will die for you. There's all kinds of people in this world. Some will lie, some, you know, it's basically that's what it is.
Is it frustrating for you to not remember your own song?
Oh, can I tell you, I have the worst memory. I mean, I can't remember words to... All I Want to Do sometimes. And luckily my fan base is pretty, they're good sports about it. I have written some incredible lyrics on the spot during my shows. It's like I write it, and once I've written it, then it's written and I can move on. So
then you don't need to remember it anymore.
I have to go back and study my lyrics before I tour.
Now, you mentioned when you were growing up, your parents listened to everything from like Cole Porter to James Taylor. Mm-hmm. Is there a song or two that you feel is like the template in your mind for music? Like you heard it so much or loved it so much during your real formative years as a young girl?
Yeah, a few songs. Someone to Watch Over Me was one. Somebody Loves Me, I Wonder Who It Could Be. A lot of the old big band stuff. My parents were in a big band when I was a child, and they would come home on the weekends with all
their
buddies.
They were in a big band?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they played locally. There were a couple of guys who actually had played with Tommy Dorsey, and they came back to Kennett and put together a band, and my parents, my mom played piano and sang, amazing singer. My father played trumpet, and they would come home after their gigs and put on records, and also they'd play along and dance, and I slept on the stairs because I didn't want to miss any of it, as did my sisters and my little brother. And I just assumed that every kid had that's what their parents did, because I didn't have any other references. So I grew up with just an amazing dictionary of jazz artists and big band artists, like Stan Getz and Stan Kenton and obviously Ella and all the great crooners. But a lot of those old songs were, to me, what songwriting was about.
So do you think that those songwriters, like the American Popular Songbook kind of songs,
Cole Porter,
affected your idea of what a good song is?
Absolutely. And then later on, you know, we had the Beatles, which I think was a continuation of incredible melodic songwriting. But I grew up playing the piano, as did all the kids in my family. And so when I started writing songs, you know, I went to Elton John. He was probably the first. I could play by ear. So he was really the first I could really relate to. She packed my bags last night, pre-flight, 9 a.m. You know, stuff like that, with those great soaring hooks. It was why I wanted to be a songwriter. James Taylor, writers that just took you there.
Did you sing with your parents?
I did. I was terribly shy about it. And I had parents, of course, who would, you know, do play so-and-so, you know, for our friends. I can remember actually playing, the song that I remember playing and busting out on my parents was, whoa, 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 my love does it good, and my dad's face turning red. And that was my first experience with censorship of him saying, do you know what that means? What does that mean to you? My love does it good. Look, you little seven-year-old.
So. He shouldn't have said anything, otherwise you wouldn't even have thought about it.
I know, exactly.
Now, you started off as a professional singer, I think, singing jingles.
Mm-hmm. I started off actually as a school teacher in St. Louis, and I was living in St. Louis and singing in bands, as I had done throughout college. And this wonderful producer, Jay Oliver, came in and asked me if I would come into a studio and sing a commercial. I'd never sung on a mic in a studio. I'd never been in a studio. So it was a great learning experience, and he was so generous in teaching me really how to work a mic. And one of the first things we did was a McDonald's commercial out of Chicago, regional, and then it went network. And it was, it's a good time for the great taste of McDonald's, which we all know. But they had me do voices. It was for a campaign, and they wanted this cow to have animated voices like Marilyn Monroe. E-I-E-I-O, or Aunt B, E-I-E-I-O, you know, all these different characters. And so, and that's what ultimately sent me out to L.A. I quit my teaching job and took my tape of, or my reel, as they called it, of jingles, and started getting some work.
So that was your your profession for a while, singing
for about 6 months, and then I landed the Michael Jackson gig as a backup singer.
Was there an audition for that, or did
there
they
was.
Just hear you on a commercial?
No, there was, and I was a pretty sly cookie. I was in a jingle session and overheard some singers talking about this audition that was based on recommendation through either Bruce Wedeen or Rod Temperton or Quincy Jones. And I found out where it was, and I just went. And they didn't kick me out. They just assumed I was there on recommendation. And I stood in front of a video camera and said, hi, Michael, my name's Cheryl Crow, and I'd love to go on the road with you. And I got called back. I don't know what, no singing or anything. I got called back, and I was put with three other singers, three males, fantastic singers, and we auditioned together. And we got it.
Wait, are you saying that you did your audition without singing?
Yeah. And I have this funny feeling that, to be honest, that I got the audition because, I mean, I looked like I had just rolled in from the farm. I mean, I had just moved from Missouri. I looked like a school teacher still. And I think he probably thought I was so harmless that having me out there was going to be a no-brainer. I don't know.
Why would Michael Jackson want somebody who looks so harmless?
I don't know. I mean, I think at the time it was all starting to swell with the Wacko Jacko and the hyperbaric chamber and the, you know, just all that stuff. I can't even venture to guess why he would have picked me, but There you go.
So what did you have to sing as the backup singer?
Well, I sang, I just can't stop loving you, oh, baby. And I sang, she says I'm the one.
Oh, great. Uh-huh.
I did a
that
lot
must
of...
must be thrilling.
It was unbelievable. Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that aside from all the crazy circus around him, he's truly one of the most remarkable performers ever. I mean, I look back on the early stuff. I can remember seeing him on variety shows as a little Michael and singing the Frank Sinatra tunes and just how phenomenal he was. But to be on the side of the stage and watch him bust out some of those moves that he created and knowing how hard it is to come up with something that no one has ever envisioned, the originality in that, that's really, that's anointed stuff. That's the kind of artistry that you dream about.
Wait, what year was this?
This was the Bad Tour. It was 1989. 88 and 89.
Did you have to dance?
I had to dance, yes, in like 5-inch heels. I came home with the biggest set of corns on my toes you've ever seen, and I still have them. Those are my war wounds from the from the Michael Jackson tour.
If you're just joining us, our guest is singer-songwriter Sheryl Crow. She was in the Fresh Air Studios this past winter with her guitar, talking to Terry Gross. She's on tour this summer promoting her most recent CD, which is called Detours.
Yeah, so when you stepped out and became a solo artist, did you know who you were on stage, who you wanted to be on stage?
I really had the luxury of touring for a very long time before I made it. And I look at these kids today, I sound like an old fogey, but who are becoming huge via TV performance. And I feel like I was so lucky to get in under the wire, being able to tour. We toured the first record, in fact, for a year and a half before All I Want to Do ever came out. And that was a very, very fertile learning ground for me.
Were there pressures on you as an attractive young woman to be the kind of, you know, sexy, like post-teen,
way post-teen. I only got my record deal when I was like 26 or 27. Most people's careers today are over by then.
But were there pressures like to sell you on sexuality?
Oh, an immense amount of pressure. And if you look back on the early records, the artwork, I mean, I'm like no makeup. I look like I dragged something out of my brother's closet and threw it on. And I was so adamant about not being perceived as beautiful that I kind of, in many ways, betrayed myself because I didn't allow myself to just be who I was because I wanted so badly to be taken seriously. And that's probably part of the psychology of my being where I am is that for me, making music was, I wanted to be respected. I wanted to write music that really made a difference. And so you're in total conflict at all times when you're dealing with commerce and perception and image. And so I felt like for the first 5 or 6 years, particularly on the second record, when you look at that artwork and I'm wearing like black makeup and I felt like I was just at odds with the industry and the business all the time, that I just wanted to play and to be taken seriously and not have to do sexy videos and look a certain way. Now I'm sort of more comfortable with it and I enjoy, you know, not looking like a street urchin.
you were a cheerleader in high school.
No.
You weren't? Oh, I had read that you were.
I was a drum majorette. I was the marching band leader.
Oh,
so.
Okay. So you baton twirling and
all that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was a big baton twirler.
Wow. How'd you learn how to do that?
I guess I started taking lessons as an early kid. And I, you know, I mean, I actually was like, I could twirl 3 batons and knives and fire and all that stuff. But ultimately wound up becoming the drum majorette, which was fun.
Any opportunity to do that on stage?
Oh, I have a number of times, Terry, yes. Usually, actually, I've done it twice. We did it on our last gig with the Wallflowers, you know, when you pull out the last night antics. And I stood behind the Wallflowers in a bikini, like laughing with words written all over me and lipstick and twirled a baton. And then with John Mayer last summer, we did the same thing. We all came out and I twirled.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Now, one of your songs, Every Day is a Winding Road, was used as a commercial.
That's right, for Subaru.
How did it transform the song to you? when it got played over, and that was such a widely run commercial. I mean,
it really was.
You couldn't miss it.
Yeah, I get a bit itchy about things like that, and I'm sure most artists do. When I was coming up, an artist would never have sold a song to a commercial. That would be the quintessential selling out. And I think when Sting got in the Jaguar and Bob Dylan was in the Victoria's Secret commercial, it felt like, okay, the floodgates have been opened. And now that our industry is really suffering so badly, the best way to get marketing dollars and to have your music heard is through a commercial, because TV is where it's at. And so we bit the bullet and did it. And it was interesting. I mean, I would hear it all the time. And my fear was that people would just associate the song with a car commercial. But that remains to be seen. But, you know, in many ways, it I think it really managed to once again cement that song into people's consciousness.
Cheryl, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you, since you have your guitar, to perform the title track of your CD, Detours.
To.
And again, if you would introduce it to us.
Well, this song is called Detours, and the album is called Detours because it's about the many journeys that we all go on that lead us far away from who we know ourselves to be, and how ultimately that detour demands that we come back and really remember who we are, or at least reinvestigate who we wanted to be. And this song was written after my relationship fell apart. And I think of my mom has been such an amazingly important person in my life, but also I think of God every now and again as a, it could be a mother or a father. And so that's kind of where it is. So it's a little bit like a prayer. Mother, can you hold me together? It's so dark and I'm losing my way. I took all of these detours to find love, but when I did, it just faded away. What do I do with this sweet love of mine? Do I hide it away and hope someday I'll find someone half as awake as the moon and the stars? Mother, teach me to love with a paper-thin heart. Mother, your words are so soothing. You speak of love and of light and of peace, but I've made it my course to avoid you, just to hide from these feelings of grief. Now what do I do with this sweet love of mine? Do I hide it away and hope one day I'll find someone half as awake as the moon and the stars? Mother, teach me to love with a paper-thin heart.
Well, thank you very much for doing that, Cheryl.
Sure.
And that's Sheryl Crow doing a song that's featured on her new CD, which is called Detours, and that in fact is the title track. You wrote that song before you became a mother, didn't you?
I did.
It's about your mother, but now you're a mother too. Does the song have different meaning for you now, knowing?
It does. I had to write a song for a movie called Grace Is Gone, which was about this father whose wife is killed in the Iraq War, and his dilemma throughout the movie is how to break it to his children. And I wound up writing this song for Wyatt, called Lullaby for Wyatt. So having him in the studio at 3 weeks old, for me, it was an amazing experience because it just rendered me completely fearless. Just having him there made me not be able to edit myself. So the last song on the record that you hear is Lullaby, and the last thing that you hear on the record is his voice.
It's been wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for talking with us and for playing for us. We really, really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. It's great Cheryl to be Crow. Here. I love this program.
Cheryl Crow, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. Cheryl Crow is on tour all summer, and her latest CD is called Detours. Our sound engineer for that studio visit was Audrey Bentham. After good reviews but middling box office for his movies Spanglish and Rain on Me, Adam Sandler returned to gross-out slapstick with last year's I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. Now he mixes it all up with politics, and you don't mess with the Zohan. Sandler plays an Israeli Mossad agent who flees to New York to become a hairdresser and eventually gets a job at a salon owned by a Palestinian. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Last week on Fresh Air, I spoke of liking the film of Sex and the City, and I stand by that review, even if everywhere I look, there are jerks impugning my manliness. The magazine I write for, New York, ran an online item in which men were asked what they'd rather do than sit through the movie, and the answers ranged from eating someone else's booger to being mauled by Michael Vick's pit bulls. Excuse me, but I happen to be confident enough in my heterosexual masculinity to enjoy seeing how the female half lives, loves, and wears fabulous clothes. And on my side, I have the Zohan. That's the Zohan of You Don't Mess with the Zohan, Adam Sandler's Israeli Mossad super warrior, master of hand-to-hand to elastic feet combat, and a babe magnet who can satisfy harems of hot chicks, plus scores of eager ladies over 60. He is serenely generous with his favors. But he's tired of war. He dreams of giving up fighting and becoming a hairdresser, like his hero, Paul Mitchell. He loves the poofy, feathered look that was big around 1985. During a battle royale with John Turturro's Palestinian super-terrorist, the Phantom, Zohan fakes his death and hightails it to New York, where no one wants to give him a job styling hair. This is perhaps understandable. His tryout at a children's salon suggests a certain lack of finesse when it comes to the needs of the clientele.
A big part of our job here is making this a fun experience.
Of course, of course.
For a lot of kids, this is their first haircut, and it can be very frightening for them.
I can imagine.
I don't want a haircut! Get away from me! Let me go!
Young man, you know, you shouldn't jump around when this nice woman's holding a sharp pair of scissors. If you move, she could slip and slice your jugular vein on accident. There's no way to stitch the jugular. All of your blood will be on the floor in 4 minutes. I've seen this. I've done this. You don't want this.
You Don't Mess with the Zohan is metrosexual camp. It's all cartoony slapstick and racial caricature, and look at the tatas on that hot babe reaction shots. That said, it's co-written by Sandler, Judd Apatow, and Triumph the Insult Dog's Robert Smigel, and it's often very funny. Turturro gives flabbergasting bird warbles of rage, and even Rob Schneider has moments as a Palestinian cabbie who can't get past the Hezbollah headquarters' automatic answering system. But the movie is nowhere near the class of Sandler's last, I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which in its adolescent way was more powerfully in your face against homophobia than even Brokeback Mountain, something most critics missed, perhaps on account of there being other things in your face, like the 600-pound man cutting the cheese with Sandler's head wedged between his legs. But even at Zohan's most juvenile, there's something mesmerizing about Sandler's messiah fantasies, ego baths only a major movie star could give himself, like being a sex god, a biblical warrior, and a finicky hairdresser. He even bridges the gap between himself and the Palestinians who want to kill him. Sandler satirizes his potency at the same time he peddles it, yet he never falls into the Jerry Lewis mode of naked self-infatuation. Something fog-bound in his demeanor takes the edge off, a quality Paul Thomas Anderson used in Punch-Drunk Love, in which Sandler played an emotionally over-defended child man floating through the world in a lyrical bubble. He has a layer of irony under a layer of tenderness, under a layer of irony, with a pool of anger that moves around like Jupiter's great red spot. Some performers become stars because we can read them instantly, while others, like Sandler, because we never tire of trying to get a fix on them. Who is he really? Based on Zohan, he's the sort of man with whom I'd want to knock back shots, put firecrackers under some preening yuppie's chair, and yes, go to Sex and the City.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
Thank you.